going down to Guantanamo is a surreal experience.
Gabor Rona is a law professor at Cardozo Law School and in the past served as the International Legal Director of Human Rights First.
Anybody who's ever been on a U.S. military base, especially a large one, will know that, you know, it's almost like being in suburban America. There's housing, there are schools, there are McDonald's, there are, you know, drive-in movie theaters. And all of these kind of touch posts of American life are just as present at Guantanamo as they are in any other large military installation in the United States. The surreal thing about that, of course, is that Guantanamo also houses an extremely secretive prison in which unlawful detention and torture of detainees went on for quite a number of years. Unlawful detention continues today. In the meantime, the military commission trial system operates under a delusion that's reflected in a plaque that you can read as you walk into the courtroom out front. It says that the U.S. military is honor bound to defend freedom. The extent to which honor is present in Guantanamo is really questionable given the nature of the detention proceedings and the trial proceedings there. But it all operates under this facade of normalcy that is hiding something that is actually very dark and ugly.
You're listening to Bar Crawl Radio, usually at a bar, but today we're on Zoom. And I'm Alan Winson. Okay, fellow Americans, let's gather together for a few minutes to hear an American horror story. Another great American horror story. This one is ongoing for two decades off the coast of Florida. But it is reminiscent of so many American horror stories of power and corruption and control and our desperate need for comfort and to look away from awful things we do to others. This story centers on horrendous torture of a few guilty men, sure, and many, many innocent men accused of attacking America on September 11, 2001. Let's call this American horror story We Are Guantanamo. And we'll start part one of this conversation with Gabor Rona. And I'll let him introduce himself.
I don't work at Human Rights First now.
Okay.
I'm exclusively a law professor now at Columbia and Cardozo Law Schools. I was the international legal director at Human Rights First for 10 years, ending about 8 years ago.
So, Gabor Rona, could you tell us how you got involved with Guantanamo? And
yes, certainly. I first became involved with Guantanamo issues early in 2002, which is shortly after Guantanamo was opened as a detention center. At that time, I was a legal advisor in the legal division of the International Committee of the Red Cross. The ICRC is the organization that provides protection and assistance to victims of armed conflict and serves as the guardian of the Geneva Conventions, which are the international laws of armed conflict. So when I was in the legal division, I was responsible for analyzing U.S. counterterrorism policies in connection with the so-called War on Terror, and for dealing with U.S. military and civilian political authorities on the application of the laws of armed conflict, the Geneva Conventions, to the U.S.'s detention policies and practices, which included secret detention, disappearances, torture, and the imposition of unfair trials.
And it seems to still be going on, this war on terror. Is it a war?
You know, I don't have much difficulty with the use of the term war in connection with the early stages of, you know, U.S. military activities in Afghanistan against the Taliban. They were the governing authorities then, or even against Al-Qaeda on a global level. I think the United States certainly was in an armed conflict, as that term is understood in international law and by the Geneva Conventions. I do, however, take a great issue with the concept of a war on terror. So just let me explain the distinction. The laws of war create obligations for parties to armed conflict and for people. You know, you can't commit war crimes. Because of those obligations, there has to be accountability, and the accountability has to be directed at people. You can't have a war on terror. You can have a war against the Taliban. You can have a war against Al-Qaeda. U.S. can have a war against Germany and Japan. But terror cannot be a party to an armed conflict. And it's such a vague term that it's used to cover a multitude of ills that the U.S. has been involved in ever since its reaction to 9/11 back in 2001 and 2002. But it actually abuses the very concept of laws of armed conflict, because you simply cannot have a war against a common noun. You can only have wars against proper nouns. It mixes up the application of powers that laws of armed conflict allow, for example, killing people and detaining them without due process of law, in ways that international law never really permitted that to happen. The essential problem with applying law of armed conflict authorities to policing behaviors or other things that don't actually amount to armed conflict is that you are then ignoring all the international human rights law protections concerning the right to not be arbitrarily deprived of your life, the right to not be arbitrarily deprived of your liberty. And you're throwing all those human rights protections out the window by saying that what really isn't a war is a war.
Is there any legal basis for keeping these Muslim men at Guantanamo as something that comes out of a war, you know, theory or whatever? Is there any legal basis for it?
There is a legal basis under the Geneva Conventions and under other parts of international law related to the regulation of armed conflict to detain people, for example, POWs, prisoners of war, when they are either members of the opposing military forces, and even if the opposing military forces aren't a state, you know, like Al-Qaeda, there is international legal authority for detention. But your question was, can they be detained at Guantanamo? And that presents a lot of problems in connection with compliance with international law, because Guantanamo was established essentially as a law-free zone. The reason the United States established Guantanamo is because it's outside the purview, or at least so they thought, the Bush administration thought, it would be outside the purview of any legal protective regimes where the laws of armed conflict or human rights law could actually be applied. In other words, they wanted a black hole in which to detain individuals. And even in armed conflict, you can't simply secretly detain people. You can't disappear people. And that's what Guantanamo was meant to do.
How is it that they're getting away with this? How is it that after two decades, we still have this black hole that is essentially accepted by the American people?
I have to go back into a little bit of the history of Guantanamo and opposition to Guantanamo after it was established in 2002. The Bush administration did not want to, as I mentioned before, detain people anywhere where they feared that a court could rule on the legitimacy of the detention itself or the conditions under which detainees were being held. When the Obama administration came into power in 2009, one of the first things that Obama wanted to do by way of executive order, he said, we're going to close Guantanamo. Well, there was a very substantial political outcry in response to that. In fact, you know, one of the more notorious detainees at Guantanamo, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is alleged to be the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, the Obama administration wanted to transfer him to federal court in New York for trial instead of leaving him in Guantanamo. If that had happened, I think Guantanamo would be closed by now. But instead, what happened was that the New York congressional delegation, in particular Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer, was very publicly opposed to bringing Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to New York for trial, and the Obama administration backed down.
Why was Schumer against it?
Because I think there was a lot of fear, unjustified, on the part of his constituency that bringing Guantanamo detainees onto U.S. soil would somehow create, you know, the risk of terrorism happening again in New York, or the risk of you know, these detainees escaping and committing terrorist acts against New Yorkers. It was a lot of fear-mongering at that time. And had the Obama administration done better homework in trying to assuage the New York political establishment that New York and the federal courts could handle these cases properly, then Khalid Sheikh Mohammed would have been transferred to federal court. And I doubt that Guantanamo would still exist today. But the reason it continues to exist today is that once Obama lost that fight back in 2009, Congress has since then, every time it authorizes a Defense Department budget, it writes into the authorization, the National Defense Authorization Act, that no funds that are designated for national defense to the Pentagon, et cetera, can be used to transfer Guantanamo detainees onto U.S. soil. And that's why Guantanamo remains open. Of course, in addition to the fact that there are still a few Guantanamo detainees that are slated for trial. And then even among those who are not slated for trial but have been cleared for release, it is extremely difficult to find places to which they can be sent, that other countries that would accept them, that would not create a risk of their being, you know, further tortured or unjustly detained.
And I think it should be validated or verified that the men that are there now, many of them had nothing to do with 9/11. Is that true?
Well, not only the men that are there now, but of the more than 700 people who have gone through Guantanamo and spent varying degrees of time there as detainees, you know, some many, many years, the vast majority of them had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11. I think it's important to understand how and why Guantanamo came to be populated. I never believed that Guantanamo was a response to U.S. national security needs. I think it was a response to the felt need of the Bush administration, Rumsfeld, and others for a public relations win. They had to be seen to be doing something. And in order to populate Guantanamo, U.S. forces, for example, shot out vast numbers of leaflets out of helicopters, out of airplanes in Afghanistan, offering humongous sums of money to anybody who would turn in terrorists. Now, you know, if you're a farmer in Afghanistan and you're having a dispute with your neighbor about anything, you could reap incredible financial rewards for turning him in as a terrorist. And that's exactly what happened. So large numbers of Guantanamo detainees ended up there because the U.S. was offering financial rewards for turning people over to U.S. authorities. That's why also the vast number of Guantanamo detainees were never slated for trial. They were only held on the merest suspicion of being a threat to the U.S. because somebody had turned them in.
And then they were tortured.
And then they were tortured.
Right. And repeatedly tortured over many years.
That's right. And the frustration of detaining authorities, some of them who I think must have felt in good faith that there's got to be a good reason these people are here, were extremely frustrated in not being able to get actionable intelligence out of them. Well, the main reason that they couldn't get actionable intelligence out of them is because most of these people had nothing to do with terrorism or with 9/11. But that created a sense of frustration among the detaining authorities. And I think that fed the torture machine. Yeah. I've been to Guantanamo a couple of times. In my time as a legal advisor for the ICRC.
The ICRC is the International Committee of the Red Cross.
I did not visit Guantanamo. I'm an American, and the ICRC is not going to send Americans to investigate an American detention facility. But once I left the ICRC and went to work as the International Legal Director of Human Rights First, a U.S.-based human rights advocacy organization, that's when I took my trips to Guantanamo. And I did not visit detainees. Virtually nobody gets to visit detainees, whether they're from international organizations or U.S. organizations or press. Only the detainees' lawyers have regular access to detainees. What I witnessed at Guantanamo, though, were the military commission trials that are being run there against certain detainees. Going down to Guantanamo is a surreal experience. Anybody who's ever been on a U.S. military base, especially a large one, will know that, you know, it's almost like being in suburban America. There's housing, there are schools, there are McDonald's, there are, you know, drive-in movie theaters. And all of these kind of touch posts of American life are just as present at Guantanamo as they are in any other large military installation in the United States. The surreal thing about that, of course, is that Guantanamo also houses an extremely secretive prison in which unlawful detention and torture of detainees went on for quite a number of years. Unlawful detention continues today. In the meantime, the military commission trial system operates under a delusion that's reflected in a plaque that you can read as you walk into the courtroom out front. It says that the U.S. military is honor bound to defend freedom. The extent to which honor is present in Guantanamo is really questionable given the nature of the detention proceedings and the trial proceedings there. But it all operates under this facade of normalcy that is hiding something that is actually very dark and ugly.
This idea that America is an honorable state, an honorable society, that lives to support the law and justice is also surreal. Though we have these shopping malls, just as you described at Guantanamo, we have them all. But underneath all that, there's a surrealist quality to our country that is totally not that. It's like we're crazy. Can you talk about that we are Guantanamo?
Well, I do think it is fair to say that to some extent, Guantanamo represents something larger about America. One of the things that I think it does represent is that Americans, as a general matter, I think are not particularly interested in the details of what its government is doing in its name. I think also it reflects that there has been a rather successful campaign in the United States to vilify Muslims as an entire group. And so the idea that what happens in Guantanamo stays in Guantanamo is something that a lot of Americans are entirely comfortable with. And then the nature of the treatment that Guantanamo detainees have been receiving and the complaints that those of us in the human rights establishment have made about, you know, cruel and unusual treatment of detainees. Well, that, you know, that language comes out of the U.S. Constitution. And yet, if you investigate how U.S. prisons operate and the abject failure that advocates have had in contesting inhumane conditions in U.S. prisons through citing the constitutional prohibitions against cruel and unusual treatment, you'll see that what passes for acceptable at Guantanamo also, to a large extent, passes for acceptable in U.S. prisons as well. And then I guess finally, I would say as a broad observation, Guantanamo reflects us because of the disconnect between what U.S. authorities say Guantanamo is and what it actually is. A lot of the policies and practices after 9/11 were not so much about actually protecting America, but rather for creating appearances. And I think that also reflects an unfortunate kind of lack of engagement by the American public in what their government is doing. And unfortunately, that in so many respects, we as Americans tend to be satisfied by public relations stunts that are meant to satisfy our fears and concerns rather than looking into what policies and practices are actually doing to kind of reflect our interests, whether they're economic or social or national security. So I think Guantanamo is a reflection of all of that. You know, one of the things you might be interested in, Alan, you might want to talk to some of the family members of 9/11 victims who have for years been going down to Guantanamo to monitor the military commission trials. So many of them have become so disillusioned with not just the military commission system, but the very existence of the detention facility in Guantanamo. And these are people who have a great deal of credibility in their, you know, desire to see justice, you know, done for their lost loved ones.
I then asked Gabor Ronup whether Guantanamo prison would ever be closed.
Let me back up historically a second for that. you know, Guantanamo existed as a detention facility long before 9/11. Guantanamo has been a U.S. military outpost for, I don't know, 150 years. And it was originally established by agreement between U.S. authorities and Cuban authorities as a refueling post for American seagoing vessels. As a detention facility, even before 9/11, Guantanamo was used to house Haitian refugees. So when you ask about the future of Guantanamo as a detention facility, what's particular to the post 9/11 experience is not that Guantanamo houses detainees, but that Guantanamo has been housing armed conflict detainees as opposed to, say, refugees. But and not only that, but using Guantanamo as a place to operate what I call kangaroo court trials, because, for example, they don't prohibit the introduction of evidence gained through torture against these detainees. I think that Guantanamo as a armed conflict detention facility and as a place for trials of such detainees can only be expected to cease when the last of the existing Guantanamo detainees dies. I'm very pessimistic because the U.S. has painted itself into such a close corner by torturing people who have credibly been accused of doing terrible things, being responsible for the 9/11 attacks. You can't try them in any sense that creates justice because of what we did to them. On the other hand, we can't let them go because of what they did to us. And so I don't see a way out, at least as concerns those Guantanamo detainees who are credibly charged with responsibility for 9/11. For the other detainees, I'm hopeful that eventually a way will be found to let them start lives in other places. But even those folks, some of them are now old, and as a result of what they've been through, are extremely damaged, sick, injured, damaged people who may, you know, also just have to spend the rest of their lives at Guantanamo. So my fear is that Guantanamo will not close as an armed conflict detention facility until the last of the present detainees passes away. And it's interesting also to see that I think the U.S., the government, I think kind of accepts that as a probability. So much of the attention and funding in connection with maintenance of Guantanamo as a detention facility now focuses on medical care, medical treatment, you know, elderly care issues. I think the supposition on the part of governing authorities is also that, you know, they're stuck with these detainees for the rest of their lives, for the rest of the detainees' lives.
Yeah. What happens if Americans in general, both on the MAGA side and the extreme left side, and all those in the middle, what if they became aware that what you're saying, and they understand what you're saying, is in fact true?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's still the problem, the psychological problem for Americans of having to release without accountability those who were responsible for 9/11, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I think as far as other detainees are concerned who have not been credibly charged with terrorism-related crimes, I think it's very difficult after the U.S. has hounded the American public so hard for so long about how dangerous and how guilty all of these people are, in spite of the fact that, you know, those allegations are largely false. I think it'd be very difficult to get public opinion turned around sufficiently, because then everybody would have to admit that they were duped. They were duped by the American government for so long. But if that were to be possible, I think there is still the intractable problem of what to do with the guilty ones as opposed to the innocent ones that are detained there.
Yeah. I mean, my concern is with those people who are innocently there and have, like, their lives have been ruined for doing nothing. Of course, the ones who were possibly guilty, yeah, they need to have their day in court. As all human beings who are accused need. Yeah.
Gabor Rona then addressed the question of what needs to be done to prosecute those Americans who were responsible for the brutal torture of the Muslim men at Guantanamo.
There was this, you know, massive Senate investigation chaired by Senator Feinstein, well over 1,000 pages of evidence and findings concerning the U.S. torture regime post 9/11, not only Guantanamo, but in other, you know, CIA secret sites. But that report remains, there's an executive summary of it that was published, but the report itself remains classified. And then there were efforts to have the International Criminal Court take up investigation of U.S. CIA and military authorities, as well as political authorities, who are responsible for establishing and carrying out the torture regime. Those kind of died out. Another little nuance that I think is really interesting and unknown. The U.S. had a War Crimes Act that had jurisdiction over Americans who commit war crimes. Mm-hmm. But after Guantanamo was established, Congress amended the War Crimes Act to exclude as war crimes the things that Americans were doing to Guantanamo detainees, namely inhumane treatment was taken out of the war crimes law, and subjecting people to unfair trials was taken out of the war crimes law. It's a tacit admission that we knew that what we were doing were war crimes, and yet there's been no accountability under the War Crimes Act or under, you know, any other methodology. People have successfully sued only the psychologists who were contracted by the Pentagon to fashion interrogation techniques, but those who actually implemented them, those who were responsible for the creation of these interrogation techniques, who are in the U.S. government, in the U.S. military, have entirely escaped accountability. And even Obama, in response to concerns about holding the torturers accountable, famously said, you know, that, you know, my intent is to look forward, not to look back. And ironically, I think shortly after that, you know, he went to Indonesia, where he grew up, and made a speech about the Sukarno dictatorship abuses there. Yeah. And said, well, you can't look forward without looking back. So it just kind of cements this notion of U.S. hypocrisy that, you know, whatever we do is okay, what other people do is not okay. And this all feeds into the failure of accountability in the U.S. for the responsibility that we have for having tortured people. Well, and I'm so glad that you're doing this, because it would be horrible if Guantanamo continues to exist simply because it's forgotten.
Thanks again to Gabor Rona, formerly the International Director of Human Rights First, for these important insights on my country's brutality at the Guantanamo Bay detention camp on the southeastern side of the island of Cuba. You're listening to Barkroll Radio. I'm Alan Winston. You can contact me at barkrollradio@gmail.com.